Well, welcome. My name is Becky Wang. I am from Saatchi, New York. I run the Insights and Analytics Group out there, and I'm also a digital planning director. Thank you for joining me today on my panel. It is a beginner panel about how your data can predict the future. Just a couple housekeeping notes. Hashtag happy data. My at name is Nausicaa on Twitter. Feel free to ask any questions. Get in touch with me that way. I'm happy to respond to you. Just give me a little bit of time. Okay? Awesome. So when I was 10 years old, I loved to read Choose Your Own Adventure books. Now, for those of you who don't know what Choose Your Own Adventure books were, they were one of the early pioneers in interactive storytelling. In fact, it's a children's game book series, about 200 in all, written in the second person, so that the reader becomes the protagonist. To read the book, you made a series of decisions from the beginning of the book to the end, so there were multiple storylines. So for example, the first page might read, you're walking through the woods and you encounter a bear. If you ignore the bear and keep walking, turn to page 42. If you try and dance a jig with the bear, turn to page 47. Now in this case, the outcome for each is probably death and dismemberment, but I wouldn't know that firsthand because I didn't actually read it all the way through. Instead, what I did is I started at the end. In fact, I was flipping backwards, trying to map out the outcomes that I wanted to see what sort of future would fit me. I didn't stop there, actually. I modeled backwards from the outcome for 50 different books to figure out if there was a pattern and how I could get to the outcome I was looking for. And what I learned in these Choose Your Own Adventure books is would soon become the center of the latest in technology trends, big data. I learned by recording my behavior, I could model out what was likely to get me the types of endings I wanted. So my discovery was that page ranges 40 to 70, there was death and dismemberment. It's kind of a dark series. The hundreds were rarely a good outcome. You ended up marrying a troll. However, if you ended up in the 90s, and frankly, don't we all wish we could be back in the 90s, we would find something really cool like discovering the Mona Lisa or killing space vampires. And for me, it was a way to figure out how I could predict my own future. And what you see here and what I want to show you is this is actually a map of Choose Your Own Adventure. Okay. So when you consolidate that into data points, you actually can start to see recursive data patterns in storylines. Okay. Now, 20 years later, the record of my actions is actually taken off my hands and now being recorded by technology vendors that I interact with or mobile devices that I carry. There are, on a given web page, 105 different vendors recording our data in terms of what we click, who we are, what we buy, and depending on what you do, that data goes to all sorts of places. The data might go to Google, who might link it to your Visa account, channel your data to Verizon if it's mobile, and then maybe through Shopkick if you're checking in on Best Buy, who might then package the data and sell it to ComScore, who sells a subscription to your aggregated data to media agencies. Or you might use your gym membership, and the gym, based on all the other people who have a profile like you, will know when you're likely to drop out. So if you're checking in, going to the gym once a week regularly, and then you suddenly drop off, they're gonna know to hit you with a coupon a month later to make sure you come back again. So data today can not only help us understand ourselves and our behavior, but it allows a reading of intention, our desires for the future, and it allows readers of that data to create opportunities to either fulfill those desires or change those behaviors. I do want to note that in this digital era, the one we are in right now, the world of big data doesn't just belong to big corporations, right? We have the opportunity now to engage in an open standard to better understand ourselves, and by extension, make opportunities to design the lives that we want to live. So I want to make sure you guys walk out of here with 7 key things under your belt, okay? The first one is a worldview of data, right? So we're going to talk about what it means to have a particular worldview of data. I promise I won't get too heady. The second thing is approaches to prediction using data. Then, with those things in mind, I want to show you some use cases specifically for advertising, since that's the particular industry that I work in. And obviously, with any sort of new worldview, we have to consider the ethics around using data. You can't really talk much about data unless you understand the basic principles of data and analytics concepts, and I'm going to tell you a bit about that. But I purposely put it at the end so we can sort of ponder what it is that we're going to do with it once we have the tools. The sixth thing is a list of really smart people, really smart websites, tools, and resources that you can get out of today. And don't worry, I'll be uploading this on SlideShare, and you can also have a link to all my bibliography so you can become your own expert. And the last thing is a prediction about data. Where is all of this big data going for us, and what are we going to do with it? So when we talk about a worldview of data, we're actually not just talking about the definition of data, okay? Here's a data set of world giving in the world. And you can actually see the outlines and traces of these different countries. And in many ways, this is what we're talking about in terms of a world view. It is a particular look at how we're going to use data, right? And a worldview for us is going to cover different things. So what is big data? Let's just define it properly. Then we'll talk about the theories of how we'll look at the data and how greatly the way we look at data affects how we use it. We'll talk about the building blocks of data and data concepts and touch upon the relationship between one another. We'll talk about how we attain the goals of what we want from data, what we should do with the data, and where we are headed. You can see I'm an analyst because I like to give you clear instruction on where we're going. So big data doesn't need to come from a number two pencil of a 10-year-old girl anymore. It's obviously everywhere, and it continues to be everywhere. So let's start with the early definitions. Frank Moss, who is the former director of the MIT Media Lab, defines it as a societal nervous system about people. Every time we perform an action, we leave behind a mountain of data that provides us with a treasure trove of information. And this spans all industries. It affects advertising, science, law enforcement, journalism, politics. It's easy to be unclear about what it means, so in this next few set of definitions, we'll really get a sense of what we're talking about here. Big data obviously is very sexy and mysterious too. More recently, the New York Times explained big data as big analysis, and it's actually looking at the information in ways to find new patterns for prediction. So this is actually an evolution of that definition, right, and how we're starting to look at it and talk about it now, right? And most recently, at the Strata Conference in San Francisco, which was actually last month for a bunch of data geeks, who I love, the Seattle Times called big data the transformative power of technology and storytelling. Okay? And this is really important because now we're starting to contextualize and humanize big data. We are actually describing it in these really distinctive human capacities of power, transformation, and storytelling. That's huge. The rise of big data has been driven by the explosion in the web. So a little tiny history lesson. While there have been massive data sets that have existed in the silos of IBM, Pfizer, Citibank for years, right? And this is sales data, R&D data, interviews, media spends. They were all encoded into what's called structured data, and I'm sure many of you guys are very familiar with it. It's just a way of codifying the data so it's easy to retrieve it in a specific way, and the meaning is known. Okay? It has been the evolution of the web in the last 15 to 20 years and the proliferation of open data that has given consumers, you and me, the voice and power that we have now. Okay? So in the early days of Web 1.0, right, in the very beginning, there was one-way communication, and it was the web page, right? The difference was anyone could have one, at least relative to the cost of opening up your own brick-and-mortar store. in that evolution, we actually saw it go to Web 2.0, right? Which is dubbed, Web 2.0, where there was a movement to a communal aspect about data, which is people were actually able to respond to the things you posted on a website, right? Web 3.0, and that, to be clear, was Facebook, Twitter, places where communities could be built. Web 3.0, which is where we are right now, known as the semantic web, okay, is all the applications made possible by the encoding of these conversations in 1 and 2 into things that machines could finally read, right? So now it wasn't a human being that had to interpret what it meant when Frank put up a website selling lemonades. Machines could actually read that and know that that was a product and actually communicate with other machines. And it's that proliferation of data and meaning about data that has allowed big data and big analysis to actually happen. What we're moving towards and what we're all hoping to move towards, Seth Godin talks a bit about in defining Web 4.0. And we call that avatar-based visualization. And that's basically when we have the reasoning and the knowledge wrapped into our experiences. Okay? So, for example, we might get an email invitation, and the web would then know what's the likelihood I'm going to say yes about according to my calendar and my social interaction with this person. What are the best routes to get me there, because it'll know where I'll be at what time during the invitation and how to get there. What I should bring as a gift based on the host's preferences. And who else is likely to be there based on the shared social graph that I have with the host. Okay? So you see, just size-wise, we are not only using a lot of data, but generating a lot of data. And now we need to create what's called a knowledge layer, which is essentially applying analytics to this mountains and mountains of data. So we've actually started to use big data already for this. I'm sure many of you guys have seen the studies specifically back in 2009 where they correlated Twitter to the Dow Jones Industrial Average and found that we could predict up to 7 days ahead of time where the Dow Jones Industrial Average could go, okay? In this case, you see that it not only extends to what we do personally, but it extends to our relationships with people and how things proliferate. So at MIT, there's a researcher named Alex Pentland who tracks 60 families living on campus quarters using smartphones and sensors. He was recording movements, relationships, mood, health, calling habits, spending habits, and he found that there was not only a pattern in the human behavior, but also in our relationships. In other words, there really are influencers in our group of friends and families. And more interestingly, he could actually predict with relative accuracy where people would likely be. The data revealed subtle signs of mental illness, could predict the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which we just talked about, and actually chart the spread of political ideas. We have another researcher out of Harvard named Nicholas Christakis, who's been using mobile data to understand all sorts of behaviors, diseases, and the spread of ideas through social networks. Now, his work, termed social contagion, is the idea that people around us shape our behavior and can be used to predict our own patterns. And so by his calculation, there are a number of things that are contagious through social networks. One of them is obesity. The other one is happiness. And the other one is loneliness. So how is it that big data allows us to predict the future? Like, what are the assumptions about information and knowledge and data that allow this to happen? Right? So the first assumption is something called the mosaic theory, but the basic premise of that is that there is somebody out there who knows something you don't. The premise actually, one, allows new models and new ways of thinking to come in, but it's also the practice of putting together then many different pieces of information to get the whole picture. Okay? And we're actually going to talk a bit about that a little later on. That's the premise of prediction markets, which is what the stock market is really rooted in. So gumshoe detectives and journalists have been using this process for years, right? They go around, they interview people, they put together different pieces of information, out comes a story. right? So data is no different in that way. Financial analysts use that all the time. They speak to the president of the company, they ask their peers, they check supply chain conversations, same thing, and they piece together a story to figure out what's gonna happen next. We've also gotten a big boost from open data sources such as ScraperWiki that's trying to codify public documents into structured data sets, right? So it's easier to analyze. Our technology allows us to analyze structured data sets just a little bit easier. The second assumption we have in terms of allowing big data to help predict the future is that sentiment often precedes outcome. So this concept is actually not new at all. Economists have been using it for a really long time with the consumer sentiment index, right? Asking people how they feel to see where they're going. But we've also seen it, as stated before, in the studies that Twitter has done correlated to the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And we've also seen the use of social media sentiment to understand what the box office draw will be during the opening weekend of movies. The third assumption that's really come true for us has been the unprecedented access to data, tools, visualization, and computing power. And the big one for me is data. There are so many data sources that are now becoming available, and companies are coming into the market to make what used to be really expensive infrastructure costs boiled down to make it really easy for you to actually play with your data. And we're actually gonna go over that at the very end. So one of the things we talked about was how to think about data. It's really important, again, to process how we think about data impacts our predictions and our capabilities of actually having an unbiased prediction, okay? So the first point of view out there is that data is a revelatory tool. Big data here really just reveals the structure of our social relationships that maybe previously existed, but we couldn't really see. So in other words, data just becomes another expression of who we are, right? Like art or anything else. The other notion, actually, is that data and big data is a revolution, okay? Because big data is everywhere, the idea is that whoever is touched by it and touches it is going to shape it and shape its outcome, right? So you have to think about the way Google sees the web. Their mission in life is to index it. But it's such that our understanding of ourselves is actually shaped by how Google chooses to index data, right? Do we really want to see data that's customized just for us, right? Has that really shaped our preferences, and have we become more about what our predilections are rather than being open, curious human beings, right? On the flip side, the data and the web are really open. And so in the collection of big data, it's in this openness that we're actually able to do better unbiased predictions. Now, there are a couple people who would disagree with me on that, right? You guys may have read an article in Fast Company a few months ago by an expert blogger named Daniel Rasmus, okay? He's a big skeptic on the potentials of big data. He published a piece called Why Big Data Won't Make You Smart, Pretty, or Rich. And he discussed the ways in which big data has some serious challenges in front of it. Because from his perspective, data isn't some magic potion that can combat the chaos of the existential world, okay? In fact, he believes that because data is a revolution, there are some key challenges to actually getting meaningful predictions out of data. His first set of concerns, right here across the top, actually have to do with people and our own limitations. It's our arrogance, he says. It's the fact that when we look at data and look at models, we're just looking to confirm our worldview. We need to question our own motives, and more importantly, who minds the models? Who is that person out there who's going to actually say this model is or isn't working? His second set of concerns actually have to do with just the limitations about the process of big data, okay? Specifically that as we generate predictions, those predictions actually feed in as another input into the prediction model. And so it's that feedback loop that increases in complexity, and we won't really be able to truly predict the future. He also believes that we have a lack of models out there. How do we understand the world, and how can we use data to help us understand it better? The other thing is that inputs change, right? So you make an assumption that someone is 5'6", and people who are 5'6" are more likely to play hockey, right? But what if we took that data point when that person was 12 years old? Now, I really appreciate Mr. Rasmus's very real and very necessary questioning of data. I actually do think data, big data, can make us richer, prettier, and smarter from an individual level to a societal level, because it is all about incremental and relative change, and it's all about the intention we put behind it. If we treat big data with the same openness and respect in which we've created and continue to maintain the web, I think we have a real shot at that. Okay, so enough about theory. Let's talk about how it's actually worked for us. Okay? We see now on an individual level and the way that businesses interact with consumers. We now have companies and businesses that can predict where we're likely to go through Facebook suggested events. We know which movies you're likely to watch through Netflix. And then we obviously now have companies like Artsy, who's willing to tell us about the art that we're likely to buy. We've also seen this work on a business level. So as early as 2004, Walmart did some correlative studies and found that along with flashlights, batteries, and other emergency supplies, Pop-Tart sales also increased before a predicted hurricane. So they could actually find out if they needed to do warnings that weren't out on mass media beforehand using this data. Another company, a company that lives up to its name in this next anecdote, a recent New York Times article about Target outlined how a father found out his daughter was pregnant based on a targeted ad sent from Target. So what they did is they analyzed their customer base, and they were able to find patterns in the shopping habits of women while they were pregnant, and then applied those models to incoming consumer behavior. If they found someone that matched, they sent them advertisements for pregnancy gear. Li Feng, a large Chinese supply chain operator, actually can look across its operations to identify trends that have governmental and economic impact for China. In the southern China, for instance, a shortage of workers and new legislation raised the labor costs. So production actually migrated south. They were predicting that before it actually happened in mass. The company also got advance warning of an economic crisis and later its recovery from retailer orders before the trends became apparent. Investment analysts now use Li Feng's data to gain insights about those macroeconomic patterns. And on a global level, you guys have maybe already heard of the Nautilus SGI supercomputer that's been built out of U of I, University of Illinois. Essentially, they filled the Nautilus SGI with millions of news articles and analyzed using various keywords and geopolitical patterns to determine trends in national sentiment. Now, the computer actually has a really pretty sophisticated and impressive record. The problem was it all happened after the events happened. But I think what's important to note is that as we train it, there is some foreshadowing that can be involved, right? And right now, there is a bid for a 1 billion euro project based out in Zurich. They have 6 finalists now who are trying to build supercomputers that bring in all the models of economics, psychology, genetics, politics, medicine, sociology, everything in your college course lecture book, in order to figure out what's going to happen next. Okay? There's another project, too, that's actually looking to simulate the human brain in all its known conditions to see if we can produce a large-scale mechanism of thinking. Right? Wow, all of this powered by big data. So then let's actually talk on a scale that you and I can probably work with, right, which is ourselves as individuals and even within the context of building an analytics group within a creative environment, right? there are three approaches to using big data for predictions, okay? The first approach to it is modeling. And essentially what we're doing here is taking algorithms from electrical engineering, physics, math, and applying them to data. So in this case, let's talk about how the application of an anti-aircraft gun model against a car auction actually helps price that of actual cars, right? So at a car auction, it's actually not hard to predict the mean price of a bunch of similar vehicles, right? Just average it, you're all set. But the goal often for the people selling the auction cars is to know what the individual price of those cars would be, right? So the idea is to reduce the standard deviation around the actual prices of the car. This model that I'm about to talk about comes in once the vehicle's been priced and it sells in the auction. It's called the Kamen filter, and it was actually used in the 1960s to help shoot down airplanes that had anti-aircraft guns. So when you're targeting a fast-moving plane, you need to be able to predict where that plane is going. That means you have to model not only the object's movement, but actually estimate its state, where it is, velocity, position, acceleration, right? So you then have to keep an eye on the object by making observations and then updating your model in real time, okay? In this case, you're actually able to improve your model in real time, right? So in this case, the results was 20 to 25% better predictions of the car price, which is pretty significant for most businesses, okay? So in law enforcement, there were previous models in Philadelphia and other major cities that focused not only on the locations of where crimes occurred, but on statistics about the criminals who were committing these crimes. And they were trying to use that to model where next crimes would happen. Well, what they did instead was actually apply the earthquake model of aftershocks and actually found that they had a better rate of predicting crimes that are going to happen. Now, I think there's a parallel lecture going on that Laura Herman's doing, so I highly, highly suggest if you are interested in this, you check in with her. Here's actually my favorite. It's actually using genetic algorithms to address optimization problems with a lot of different potential solutions, okay? So, for example, say you're a pay TV provider who's challenged to schedule content it's purchased across multiple channels, right? So how do you keep the most people happy at any one time? What is that optimal schedule, right? So say you have 100 items, you have 20 channels, there are literally billions of different combinations, right? So it's not always obvious what you're gonna move where to make sure that most people are happy. So a genetic algorithm would create a population where each individual has a genome with a string and encodes a potential schedule of those channels, okay? So you run the simulations over and over again. So for example, someone liked it, but there was something else on the same time. What were the choices that they made in order to evaluate how many people would be satisfied with a particular combination, okay? You keep the ones that do best, chuck out the others, and you allow the mutations that happen based on the genetic algorithm to suggest the next generation that's faster, more optimized, stronger, right? And the process continues until after a few hundred or so generations, you actually end up with a solution that's pretty close to optimal, okay? So what's significant here is that it's not about more data, right? It's about bringing in new models of thinking through which to look at data. So models and algorithms are not only necessary for the data analytics, but they're actually really useful for us to become better thinkers. There's a gentleman named Scott Page who teaches a free online course about mental models, and I encourage everybody to just check it out. In fact, Warren Buffett and his business partner, Charles Munger, use over 100 mental models in which to make their investments. And I'd say they have a pretty good track record. So that was the first approach to data, right? Really heady, a lot of models. The second one is even brainier. It's actually the application of neural networks, okay? So in the brain, the definition of the neural network is that spontaneous order appears to arise out of decentralized networks, in this case of simple units of neurons. Okay? But this can also apply to how people rank popularity of movies that they like. For example, you might have a ton of data that shows loads of people who have ranked loads of movies, right? Collectively, without being contact, they act like a neural network. So it might find that certain people will watch more comedy. There's a learning algorithm out there called the restricted Boltzmann machine. You don't have to remember that because I never remember it. It was actually developed on a very complex probability measure of distribution, and it was actually that was used to improve the Netflix recommendation engine, okay? So these two models, I think, are really data intensive, and they focus on the process and understanding how data works together, how does our understanding of it match the outcome. This third way, in terms of approaching prediction, is the prediction markets, okay? There are a lot of vendors out there, Consensus Point, Brain Juicer, Inkling, that have really honed in not so much on the process, but the actual outcome, okay? So the stock market actually functions much like a prediction market, and I'll tell you a bit about that now, right? In theory, the stock prices that we see are a reflection of the knowledge of all the independent buyers and sellers, right? So if I know that a factory in Kansas is going to be shut down, I might decide to sell the stock, right? But somebody else knows that the government is about to put in money to save that factory and may choose to buy that stock, okay? So in that, our two pieces of information combine into a single point, right, to represent the value of the company. Now, in the stock market, it isn't actually a perfect information market because people use things like scale and the actual information about the stock has less to do with the actual value of the company and more about profit. But I think that the example remains the same, okay? The principles of information markets and or prediction markets, as they're also called, can actually be applied to understanding all these possible outcomes, right? So predictive markets is essentially just a large group of diverse people, right, buying and selling notional shares of what's considered an idea, right, to predict what other people will do. And in fact, it's actually more accurate than most kinds of concept testing we see in advertising, okay? So prediction markets actually emerged out of a book in 2004 from a gentleman named James Swierwiecki's 2004 book, Wisdom of the Crowds. And it's not just the stock market that sees it. We've actually seen applications for this in Hollywood, where there was the Hollywood Stock Exchange. We saw examples of this with DARPA when they were trying to figure out where Osama bin Laden was. Okay, so the theories behind it have actually been used to come up with outcomes we probably never could have come to because we don't understand the process, right? That's okay, because this is about how we can actually predict the future, right? This has actually been used across the board in product development efforts by GE, P&G, General Mills, Unilever. For example, the cloud-based system by this vendor, Inkling, has helped Ford Motors decide what new ideas are worth pursuing. For example, would people like an in-car vacuum? So there are lots of sample questions like that, right? What company same-source sales? In August, will they be higher or lower? Will the China generic market price go up or down? Will the price of corn go up and down? Will, you know, employment figures go up and down? It's just this collection of all this knowledge that gets summarized into a singular point. So big data now has provided us with evidence in decision-making on a social level, right? Not just the individual level that we've talked about. So the remit of advertising agencies has expanded from just how a communication message would change behavior to how an experience we create for consumers through entertainment, news, information, and more important, utility, help us with that communication message to change behavior. Okay? So a gentleman named Andrew Weingard, who is a former chief knowledge scientist over at Amazon and now teaches a class at Stanford called Social Data Revolution, he speaks about the relationship between data and behavior change, right? And the type of behavior change resulting in what's called agnostic data or just passive data, what we know about ourselves, is probably the most natural, organic form of behavior change, right? So you have companies like 23andMe, Counsyl, that can provide in-depth genetic information, making affordable full profiling of your hereditary makeup. So somebody seeing her test to see that she's predisposed to heart disease might decide to moderate her high cholesterol foods, maybe go for a run. Right? Or somebody using the smartphone app that came out of Purdue University, where you actually take a picture of your food and it monitors and tracks for you your caloric intake, might have better success at losing weight. Okay, so these all harness the basic principles of the feedback loop. The truth of the matter is, in advertising, we think we're really clever and can change these behaviors, but we really can't, or at least not very well. And that's part of why creating an analytics function within the creative agency, I think, can sort of help that, right? So the old model of advertising really just cared about motives, right? Why do people do what they do? They're looking for recognition, power, and we used to write messaging that just spoke to that, okay? But big data now brings the perspective of behavior, right? And other factors that drive purchase, advocacy, and what people are going to do. Right? So as advertisers, we know that the consumer is ruled by habit nearly 40% of the time when making product choices, right? So using data, big data, our own data, we have the ability to better understand these unconscious patterns that we've created. So for example, researchers have amassed so much anonymized data about human behavior that we've actually begun to unravel really complex diseases of behavior, like diabetes, like lung cancer, et cetera. And in fact, we can take it down to that individual level, such as breaking the cookie habit. So if you guys have read recently in the New York Times article, it was actually referenced in the same article as the Target article, is a writer named Charles Duhigg, who wrote the book called The Power of Habits, right? And he lays out basically how habits are formed, right? We have a cue. We then enter into some unconscious routine to achieve some sort of reward, right? That's great. I think we probably all knew that. But we actually can, through big data, understand the different intersection points and better elucidate what those routines are. Are those rewards really worth it? And creating new cues, okay? So here's an example. Back in the early 1900s, only 7% of Americans actually owned toothpaste, okay? But Claude Hopkins, who was trying to sell Pepsodent, learned that a harmless film naturally coats your teeth. So in ads, he would tell people that they needed to get rid of the film if they wanted to have a lovely smile. So essentially, that film turned into a cue for toothbrushing. So a decade later, after Hopkins' ads, 65% of Americans own toothpaste. And so it was not only good, obviously, for oral hygiene, but it wasn't actually all that good for removing the film. I think that gives advertising a bad name, but that was in the early 1900s, and now we are very ethical, so. Football coach Tony Dungy instituted a series of practice drills where they would go over the cue over and over and over again so that the routine was automatic, right? So this is how we develop the habits that we do, okay? So now that we understand people a little bit better, we can use our power of prediction and go deeper into the architecture to provide opportunities that people will likely participate in, specifically in advertising, okay? So I'm about to talk to you about the MAO model, which is from a gentleman named Sebastian Netterding, okay? He's actually one of the pioneers in what's called persuasive design, right, which is a discipline of interactive design. And the reason this matters is because as advertisers, like I said, we are charged with creating experiences that will bring people in contact with the clients that we represent, right? The thing is, motivation was just the start, right? But the thing is, we can actually have a better sense of motivation using big data, right? Because we're essentially able to build awareness from existing mental models that people have, I hope this is all coming together for you. Existing mental models that people have, and then building on the things that we already know, like attitudes and emotions, and then using things like social norms to provide the right context, right? So the next step, which is the realm beyond, is to build the ability of the consumer, right? So gotta build them up. So we can do this by creating interactive experiences that support visioning, guide the goal, and help implementation planning for the consumer, right? We can encourage mindfulness, help them build a little willpower, but don't guilt them too much, don't frustrate them too much, model the behavior, cheer them on, build their knowledge, and help them create a new habit, right? So I know I make it sound easy, and that's why we get paid the medium bucks to do it, and I'll show you an example of how it actually happens, right? And the last thing we do, and this is specifically true for creative agencies too, as they're competing in the media landscape, we actually have to know when we're building these campaigns, these experiences, these always-on conversations, we have to be aware of the opportunities, okay, which has usually been the remit of the media agency, right? The beauty of this is we used to have to buy volumes and volumes of syndicated research, right? And so you needed the scale of all that media money in order to purchase it. But with big data, companies like Recorded Future, Google Analytics, we now have the ability to understand the opportune times in which to communicate our message, right? We need to look for breakdowns in utility and usage, and that can help us optimize the interactive design that we have with our consumers, right? We want to create opportunities online and offline through routine, focus in on user flow interface through web and social design. So what is the outcome, right? The power of digital, which a lot of digital agencies subscribe to, and now many creative media, and anybody who's really trying to participate in the conversation about culture, is that through creating platforms that leverage utility, entertainment, information, news, we can create these cue, routine, reward mechanisms, and at least create ones that will mirror real life experiences, okay? So let's take a look at Branch Out, which is essentially a LinkedIn for Facebook. And what they've done is a primary example of measuring behavior in order to change it, right? So this is the premise of gamification, and we could only do this if we actually knew what the norms are. And we wouldn't know what the norms are unless we had big data to help us with that. In fact, that's what social data has really empowered us to do. Gamification, popular term, I'm sure there are 90 other panels on it. Is essentially talking about game mechanics, right? Points, leaderboards, competitive information here. So you'll see they have what's called a completeness meter, which essentially is letting you know, hey, if you get to the end of the path, something happens. Do you want to know what that is? Right here, you have social endorsements. Hey, other people are using it, right? So it brings in the factor of community. Here you have your stats, okay? So by measuring and explaining where you are essentially setting the stage to tell people where they're going, okay? And so this is one of the key factors in not only just predicting the future, but more importantly, creating the type of future that we're looking to have our consumers do. So I remain optimistic about the applications and implications of big data, but there are things that we should pay attention to. Please note that this is only two slides. It's not because I'm not ethical, but because somebody else said it way better than I did. 6 months ago, Dana Boyd and Kate Crawford presented a paper in London. Dana Boyd, I'm sure, is a very familiar name to you all. She wrote some really seminal works on social networks as a sociologist and anthropologist, in fact, talking about things like the migration of people from MySpace to Facebook. So she's quite the thought leader. And she and Kate Crawford, I was about to call Kate as if we were friends, but we're not, had these six provocations of data, right? So I'm just going to run through them really quickly. But they have a great paper that's published. I'll send you all a link to them if you visit my website. Really just giving you a chance to think about what are the provocations of data, right? The first one is automating research changes the definition of knowledge. So like Daniel Rasmus, he warns us to be cognizant of this gigantic leap into data is going to change what we think we know, okay? So now I'm sure you've heard people say, oh, let's just look at the data, or the data will reveal the patterns. The truth of the matter is that there is so much data out there that you run the risk of saying, let's support the data, when the data may be giving us a false positive, right, or a false correlation. So we have to be cognizant to know why we know what we know, and sometimes it's just our own life experience, right? The second thing is the claims to objectivity and accuracy are misleading, right? Data is about as truthful as a word can be, right? And so that's just a little food for thought to know that data, just because it's a number and we all know what a number means, doesn't mean it doesn't fit into a context, right? Bigger data is not always better data. Not all data is equivalent. More importantly, periodicity matters, right? So if I'm fusing data from 2 years ago to data from 5 years ago, I could have some serious false positives there. The fifth one is, just because it is accessible doesn't mean it's ethical, right? So you guys have probably heard stories about Rapleaf, Facebook, Twitter. A lot of big data companies have this issue. Just because we're outputting what's considered anonymized data doesn't mean that you can't take that anonymized data, slap it right against some publicly available data, and actually reveal the identities of individuals. It's possible, right? So I don't say that to you to scare you to not participate in big data. It just means that our intentions about it have to be really clear, okay? If we're studying to better understand ourselves, understand our own happiness, then that's the goal we should go into it with, right? And the last one is, limited access to big data creates new digital divides, right? I think pretty self-explanatory. A couple other of ethical issues that are just circulating. The first one is obviously privacy. Who owns the data? Have people consented to the data storage and reuse? Ownership, who owns it? Contribution, how do we encourage people to keep updating data so that we always have a fresh perspective in a sense of, is this about now or is this about then? Okay. So I'm just going to quickly run through some data concepts for you. This is not a technical seminar. I'm literally telling you to Google Robert Scoble and Cloudera because it will give you a really brief overview of what you need to think about in terms of data storage concepts. So as analysts, you don't need to know that, but it's probably good to be familiar with it. The actual speech is from 2010, but I think it's still pretty timely. While there are new technologies that are coming out, I think it gives a really good framework for it. The other thing is, how can you actually start to implement this into your own life, okay? And how can you implement it into an analytical environment for creative agency or any sort of path company that you're looking to build it in? This model here, I'm actually going to have to do a special call out to Hillary Mason, who is the chief data scientist over at Bitly. Okay, super smart woman, absolutely worth following on Twitter, and really has a great way to simplify this. And this is really based off of a lot of what we've talked about. The first thing is to obtain and potentially cleanse your data. So data sometimes comes in weird formats, or the data meaning in one column doesn't, or the data that you see from one set doesn't totally match the other, but needs to go through an interpretation or a data synthesis. What you see here, Numerate, Geo, Matrix Euro, Snap, these are all open data sources that any of us can access at any time, okay? So just know that these resources are available. Big data is not just simply the remit of Facebook and Twitter. Recorded Future has something for $150 a month where you can access those pipes in a consolidated manner, right? The second thing is to really explore the data, right? And so this is really in the hands of the analyst as a storyteller. And you want to, at this stage, really be able to consult people who have different mental models and data models in which to think about the relationship between all the data points. Next one is to actually model. There are companies like 11 Ants who actually have in their database over 150 statistical models in which they throw every single model at your data. That's the easy way out. It's kind of fun to try. The idea there is to codify your thinking. And then most importantly is to be able to visualize it, right? So now that you've cracked the code, you actually have to be able to show people who aren't as techie and analytical as you are. Visualization is key. So this is a great book, Visualize This. There is also the Old Bible and Testament, The Visual Display of Quantitative Data by the godfather, Edward Tufte. And remember, there's always the analyst to tell the story from the visualization. It's really good to check to see if the initial explanation has netted an unbiased response. So that's why it's super, super important to do this. So we've covered a lot today. And hopefully you have a couple provocations about data, ethics, ways of thinking about data. Here's a list of a lot of the thought leaders that I tapped into either through their blogs or conversation. This is a growing field, so I encourage you to actively participate in the discussion. The discussion, whether it's with them, whether it's with me, because we're still trying to shape how it is that we think about big data. Here's also a list of tools, platforms. Some of them, like I said, Recorded Future offers something that's pretty affordable. Palantir Technologies, which a very good friend of mine started. I'm not telling you that to send him business, but it's a really, really kick butt technology, and I think you'll start to see why, even if you just go to their marketing. 33 Cross, which we're working with, really amazing tools and vendors. So, what you've all been waiting for. So what you'll need for yourself in order to predict your own future and your own happiness, okay? Here are just some data sources, technologies, books to think about, right? The most important thing at the end of this is to understand how you work. How do you value the rewards that you give yourself, okay? Then you need monitoring software or data entry for the queue. How do you know what you're doing, right? So you might have things like Nike Plus. You might take pictures of the food you're eating. Then you need software to help you crunch it. The software is what has the models in it to basically say, oh, there seems to be a relationship to when you don't sleep, you tend to eat more. A company called TickTrack by a gentleman named Martin Binder is actually trying to do just that. He's coming out of beta very soon. I highly recommend you guys sign up and play with it. Check it out. Okay, visualization is key, even for you. Even if you understand the story, the pretty graph will help you codify it in yourself. And then iterate. Take what you learned, rinse, repeat. For the analytical department in the creative environment, and the reason I say this is, one, I come from a creative environment, but two, you don't have to be at a data warehouse to apply some of these in your marketing department, okay? The first thing is hire a team of business analysts and economics analysts. You don't necessarily need a whole team, but you need to talk to people who think in models. And they, including you, need to have a Rolodex of those model makers. And model makers just are not just technologists or economists. They're actually anthropologists, editors, authors, people who are telling us how to see the world, okay? Open data you'll need access to. Obviously, use any data set that you have too, but you have all these open data sets, which was in a previous slide. Use it. You have tools, Recorded Future, Palantir. Visualize again to make the case. This time, is it to your senior manager? Is it to your client? It's really important to do that. The other two steps is a development environment at your desktop. So even if it's not you crunching the data, that person will need to have a place to work. And I say at the very end, a creative team to prototype. At the end of the day, when you're trying to predict the future, you have to convince people why they should listen to your prediction. And oftentimes, that's explaining why you come to the outcome you've come to. And creative teams are really great at telling that story for you. Okay, and predictions about data. So there will be a time, as you see Google is allowing you to opt out of giving your data will become yours to basically buy, sell, and trade, okay? You will own it. I very much believe that that's gonna happen. The other thing that's gonna continue is this debate on open and closed data. All of us can participate in that debate, and I actually highly suggest you do, and I suggest you move towards open data, right? So that's really scary because that you might have privacy concerns about that, but ultimately at the end of the day, the more we know about ourselves and share it, the more likely we're going to understand ourselves better, right? So food for thought on that one. Another thing is an exchange for models, right? So that doesn't mean that everyone should become an economist or a statistician. There's a lot of predictions that that is the sexy career of this decade, just like being an engineer was in the 90s and the aughts. But I maintain that we still need people who are anthropologists, psychologists, teachers, artists, novelists, who are going to be painting these images for us, or excuse me, these mental models for us. The industries that we're going to see transform very quickly are real estate. It's really hard for us to understand the true value of real estate, the demand and supply side of it, the actual pricing of it, the value of it. Big data is going to help us codify that. Manufacturing, as everything starts to be tagged with RFID tags, we're going to have a huge explosion of data, right? Going to make things more easy for us, more convenient for us, and make a supply chain seamless. And then, of course, the government. So I leave you with one last thought. It's from Alan Key, a fellow at Apple Computers. The best way to predict the future, despite prediction markets, models, neural networks, is actually to help invent it. And I have 6 minutes left for questions. So thank you so much for staying and learning a bit about big data.